Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the introduction. It's great to be back at EMF after a big break. So I'm going to do a talk today on hovering rockets. Explain what those are in a second. This is the subtitle, which is how to go from a sketchy hobby project to a funded European Space Agency program in half a lifetime. So when you think of hovering rockets these days, this is what everyone probably thinks of. This is one of SpaceX's Falcon 9 rockets landing on a pad. And it needs to be able to steer itself such that it can reverse back down onto the launch pad. And that involves a bit of complexity. So another application of hovering rockets, this is the Mars, one artist's rendition, I think, of the Mars Perseverance lander. So to land on Mars, the problem you have is the atmosphere is very thin. So while you can use it to slow down initially when you're at a high Mach number, when you want to actually touch down on the surface, you need some retro rockets. There are other ways of doing it. You can crash into the surface with a big airbag or something like that. But this is a slightly more elegant way of arriving at Mars. And this needs a rocket system where you can control the stability of it very, very precisely. And you have to do that without the aid of much atmosphere. So, a brief introduction to rockets. You probably know, and most of you know all this stuff here already, but rockets basically work by ejecting stuff out the back. So this is Newton's third law. So you have some stuff in your rocket, you accelerate it to high speed, you push it out the back, and that reacts against the rocket and causes it to move in the other direction. Here's an equation. So thrust is the rate of change of momentum. And momentum is velocity times mass. So rate of change of momentum is velocity times mass flow rate. So what the V means is that's how fast you're chucking your propellant out the back. And the M dot is the rate of stuff that you're chucking out the back. So how many kilograms per second are you getting rid of? And it turns out, because rockets store their fuel on board them, you really need to worry about mass and optimizing that. So it turns out what you want is a very high V and a relatively small M dot to get a certain amount of thrust, and that way you get an efficient rocket. Sorry, that's a jellyfish. Dynamics. You don't have to pay attention to this diagram. It's just really a kind of a cue to introduce a little bit of the background to what's involved in making a rocket hover. So. I have a thing here, which I'll explain more about later, but believe it or not, this is actually a rocket, and in the bottom here is a rocket motor that you can insert in. It's not loaded at the moment, so it's perfectly safe, but that's a solid propellant rocket. And obviously the thrust causes the rocket to go up. Now, there's a common misconception that balancing a rocket or controlling a rocket is like balancing a pendulum on your hand, sort of like that. Actually, it's a slightly easier problem. The rocket isn't really, that's a completely unstable system, statically unstable, so it'll just fall over. The more it falls over, the more the thrust, the gravity is acting upwards. The rocket doesn't work like that, it's actually in free fall. So your rocket, if you let go of it, it's actually gonna fall like this. And the rocket won't rotate unless you do something to make it do that. And that's another example of Newton's third law, but applied to rotational systems rather than linear systems. So if I steer the rocket engine this way, that's going to cause a reaction that will make the rocket go the other way like that. If I steer it this way, it'll react back that way. So that's roughly how the dynamics work. And what happens is when you gimbal the rocket, it's called gimbling, by the way, so you're swiveling the rocket engine, that puts a proportion of the thrust in a sideways direction, and that's what causes the rocket to turn. And what happens is that that thrust will cause the rocket to turn faster and faster and faster and faster. So it's the angular acceleration that's proportional to thrust. So that's enough dynamics. This is how you deal with it. So this is a little control diagram. I don't have a pointer here, but on the left in the blue box, you've got an IMU. That's an inertial measurement unit. So that's essentially a thing that measures what way up the rocket is. You've then got a controller which makes sense of that data from the IMU, and then you've finally got some actuators which will do something to the rocket. Now, the one I just showed you, that's called a gimbal actuator, but you can also use cold gas jets and all sorts of other methods to actually steer the rocket. That then feeds back through the vehicle dynamics, so it makes the rocket do something. That then changes the readings that you get on the sensors. And the sensors that you'd have there would usually be three-axis gyros and three-axis accelerometers. So gyros give you rate of change of angle, and accelerometers give you rate of change of speed, sideways directions and up-down directions. So this is a little bit of history, sort of how this project started. It started when I was a student, or I think I was just moving into my first job also at a university. And I was really inspired by this thing. So this is a thing called the Delta Clipper, McDonnell Douglas DCX. It then became part of a NASA program. It sadly didn't go very far. They had a couple of accidents with it, which wasn't really anyone's fault. The essential design was very sound. And this was a rocket that could take off and it could move sideways and it could land again on a pad. And it was a technology demonstrator for all sorts of different things. It was built very quickly in a very cost-effective manner. And it's really a good example of how to run a really quick, cheap aerospace program that does something really amazing. So the question is, So I was, without access to modern MEMS gyroscopes, or they were just becoming available for model helicopter pilots. So this is going back to 1995 sort of time. So the big problem is how you make a gyro so the rocket can tell which way up it is. And this, for somebody who's essentially operating in a basement with limited tools and technology, it's a really hard problem. And I found this article from HPR Rocketry magazine. Sorry, there's a spider right there in front of me, which is great, so you can go over here, dude. These guys in America, also amateur rocketry people like I was, they figured out you could buy a thing from Edmunds Scientific, which was a little tiny magnetic disc with little magnetic poles around it, and you could put it on a little jewel bearing and spin it up to really high speed with some coils. Now, I discovered in the UK it was hard to get stuff from Edmunds Scientific, and I didn't know how to import this thing and where it came from and exactly how to get hold of it. So I started looking around for other sketchy alternatives to this, and I came up with this. So you may, if you're a cyclist, recognize this. This is called a bottle dynamo, and the idea is it rubs against your tire and it makes electricity to run the lights on your bicycle. And it turns out that inside one of these, in the little bottle bit, there's actually a rotor. And you can see there on the right-hand side, that's the rotor there. It's about 30 millimeters diameter. And it's got four north poles and four south poles. And it spins in a coil to generate electricity. So I thought, aha, what if we turn this the other way around? And so I started to try some experiments. The next problem was how to actually get a low-friction bearing. And I discovered that the Ender propelling pencil was really good because it has a little bit of graphite sticking out. So you have a graphite bearing, which is self-lubricating. So this all sounds really sketchy, because it is. But amazingly, it kind of works. So there's a diagram of it there. You can see that it has some coils around the outside to spin the dynamo disc up. It sits on a little adjustable pivot. And underneath are some infrared sensors, which measure how far away the disc is from the sensors. And by amplifying those differentially, you can then figure out what angle it is. And if you put this together, you end up with this sketchy-looking thing, which is made out of hot melt glue and balsa wood and epoxy resin and all the sort of things you do when you're bodging things together when you're a student. But amazingly, it actually works. So it's just spinning up there. The idea is it's got those little silver strips on the outside, detected by a little infrared detector on the side. That then pulses current through those red coils, and that will then spin it up. And I think in a minute I'm going to pick that up and sort of move it around. So you can see an example of here, what's called gyroscopic rigidity. So you can move the rocket around, but the gyroscope stays still. And that's how it allows you to measure the attitude of the rocket. There's one big disadvantage of this, as you can no doubt guess, which is because it's sitting on a pivot, as soon as the rocket stops thrusting, it jumps off the end of the pivot and it whizzes around inside the rocket, which is not great for it. But amazingly, it kind of works. So this is just roughly what the inside of the rocket looks like. So it's pretty old school. So there's a gyro. It feeds a little microcontroller. That operates two radio control servos, which then gimbal the engine around. And here's a film of it, filmed with a potato, because potatoes are all we really had back in the late 1990s. So you can see it's sort of stable, doesn't go very high, parachute comes out, doesn't really have time to open, and that's it. But it kind of worked. So, oh, there's another jellyfish. Gyroc number two. Then by this time, the micro machine silicon sensors became available. And these allow you to get a solid state gyroscope, which doesn't need any moving parts. And that really transformed everything. And so that we then ended up with this thing. Which, see if I can take it apart. So there's an outer shell, which was homemade out of some fiberglass wound around a drain pipe. The little brackets on the side were actually for retro rockets. They're not there anymore because it turns out that it causes it to chase you across the ground. So that's the inside of the rocket. You've got the two sensors on the back. You can see they're orthogonal to each other, so they're 90 degrees. It only measures the... ooh, just broken it. A second. This is all made out of model aircraft stuff and model boat stuff, which is great because it means it's really easy to fix. So the gyros on the back there go into a little microcontroller there, which is a PIC microcontroller. And that operates two servos here. And Eve, I'm very lucky. If I had a piece of tape here. Put some tape here to stop the engine falling out because it's only a push fit at the moment. Turn that on. Let's see. This may or may not work because I've done something to it. I made it sad. Yep, demo error. Sorry, that worked perfectly minutes ago, but now it stopped. But basically, the idea is when it tilts one way, it'll move the motor the other way to correct. That's disappointing. Demo effect in action. This is what it looks like when it flies. Again, sorry about the potato quality here. Is that going to play? Let's see. I'm not sure that you're getting any sound on there. Pick up the sound from my laptop. So you see that one, that performed a lot better, thanks to the solid-state gyros. But, thank you very much. Oops. Just gone out of my presentation. So, the problem is, if you really want to make a rocket hover, it's not enough just to control the direction of the thrust. You have to control the amount of thrust as well. So you have to throttle the engine. And this led on to a brief but abortive project called Gyroc 3, which I have here. This is a coaxial hybrid rocket engine with a pintle injector that you can throttle. It turns out, though, that you've then got a problem with thrust vectoring. You need some sort of jet vanes. And that turned out to be a bit complicated. And things were moving on, and I wanted to try out Viprox. By this time, I'd end up starting up a small company and had some other people around to help me who really wanted to join in the fun and see what we could make with bits that we had lying around the workshop. So we came up with this thing, which is Gyroc 5. So it's a gimbaled bipropellant throttleable motor, and it runs on nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas. That's the oxidizer, and isopropyl alcohol. And those two burn together in a combustion chamber and produce hot gases out of the nozzle, and that provides the thrust. And it's got a thrust of about 300 newtons, which is about 30 kilos. So that's the diagram you saw earlier on, the control system diagram of the rocket, when it was really, really simple, and you only had to worry about the attitude of the rocket. When you have to worry about the throttling it as well, and trying to make sure that the IMU doesn't drift, you need a whole bunch more sensors, and you have the challenge of putting that data together. And you use a thing called a Kalman filter, and that's basically a device that is able to adjust the amount it trusts different sources of data depending on what it thinks the accuracy of that data is. And it turns out, by some very complicated maths, which I'm absolutely not going to bore you with, it turns out that's an optimal solution for dealing with this kind of problem where you've got lots of different sensors, and some are good in a short time span and some are good in a long time span, and it's a way of getting the best of all worlds. What the actual diagram looks like, so bearing in mind this is the Gyroc 1 and 2 diagram, this is the diagram for Gyroc 5, which is considerably more complicated. So it has this Kalman filter that estimates its state, so how fast is it, what angle is it, and then it has a couple of different control loops for altitude and velocity, and it's got similar control loops for the attitude, which is its angle. And that allows it to do something like this. Now, this is just tethered. We haven't let Gyroc 5 off the tether yet, because if we have to abort it because something goes wrong, it's quite an expensive thing if it crashes. So we have a tether here with a bungee on it, and this is what it looks like. Actually supposed to be another video in there, but that seems to have gone missing. So I don't know whether you noticed that it drifted off to one side. That's because it actually lost GPS lock. We put a very tight constraint on how accurate the satellite lock needs to be in order for it to trust it, and it decided it wasn't going to trust it, so it starts to drift off, and then when it reacquires lock, it comes right back to the middle where it should be. So I think, let me just see if that's all I've got. Yeah. Sorry, I don't have the other video. So I've got to say thank you to all my colleagues at Airborne Engineering who've done all the really hard work. They're fellow nerds and makers like me who've also got a passion for rocketry. They've been absolutely instrumental in making this project happen. It's really an example of how you can make a start on something on your own, but it gets to a certain level of complexity, and it's just much much easier and more fun to have other people involved. I also need to thank European Space Agency, who've given us some money to actually start playing with something that was originally my hobby, and so that's really gratifying, and the UK Space Agency as well, who dealt with all the paperwork for making that happen. So, thank you very much.